So it's great as an observer to be here, surrounded by theorists who can try to explain some of the weird phenomena that we see that's happening in light curves. Cataclysmic variables have a lot in common with what we've heard about this morning and yesterday, but a lot of differences too. Two weeks ago, we went through all the kind of the related structures and cataclysmic variables that have to deal with accretion dust. And it took 3 days. This was Christian and Paul. So in a half an hour, there's no way I can cover all the different aspects that we can study with these close binaries. So I decided to concentrate on what I thought was going to be like the simplest thing, the light curves, because we have a lot of data that goes back many years, and especially with the sky surveys that have been going on recently, we have a lot of new data. So I figure if we can explain, if you can explain all the things that we see in light curves, then we will have a pretty good idea of how accretion is occurring in these systems. So I think most of you aren't working on cataclysmic variables, so I want to do a little 5-minute introduction to what they are and what their parameters are, so the light curves will make more sense when I go through them. So basically, we're talking about periods that are 1 to 10 hours, and in fact, the vast majority have periods between an hour and a half and 2 hours. So the 10-hour things are kind of rare. But that is, the period is one of the fundamental things that we actually have to determine when we're observing to figure out where a CV is in its evolution and understand its properties. The primary star is a white dwarf, so you're dealing with a star that has probably a higher magnetic field because it's been condensed when it became a white dwarf than you had in the Titari stars that we talked about this morning. And the primary is more massive than a typical white dwarf, which is 6/10 solar mass. We don't totally understand this. It's part of its evolution, or the fact that it's accreting matter. But they are more massive for the ones that we have masses. The secondary is a late M4 star, or even an L dwarf. So that has to be taken into account because of the tidal effects that occur because it is in a binary system. And then it has to be actively transferring mass. So the mass transfer rates are 10 to the minus 8 to 10 to the minus 11 solar masses per year. And I find it really intriguing that the Titari stars have a typical mass accretion rate the same as we have. And last week we heard a talk about Sag J, and its mass accretion rate was 10 to the minus 8 as well. So I think there's something magical about 10 to the minus 8. It's the new pi. Okay, so these are we unfortunately like the young stars. We can't do pictures with Alma because they're just too close together. We're talking about separations here about the diameter of the sun, so 10 to the 10th centimeters. So they're really close together. So there's no way we can resolve them, even with the best instruments we have coming down the pipe. But we gather the structure. So we have basically the systems that I'm only going to talk about, the ones that have disks. And so we divide them into the dwarf novae that have outbursts and the nova-likes. We know about a couple thousand at this point, but the fundamental orbital periods we only have for about 10% of those, so a couple hundred we have periods for. There's also, so the things that may be different, because we have this mass transfer stream, we also have to take into account the hot spot where that stream intersects the disk when we're doing the modeling of the disk. So it's another free parameter in there that enters into what the disk looks like. But we can also use that hotspot to give us an indication of what the size of the disk is, because during eclipsing systems, and we're talking about we can get a couple eclipses in time scales of a few hours, so during one night we can see the orbits go around twice in many cases, we do mapping and actually use that, figure out where the hotspot is, and that gives us an indication of the disk size. Okay, so I'm also going to mention something called intermediate polars, in which case the magnetic fields are in the order of 1 to 10 megagauss. And we get that field strength from circular polarization that exists for a couple of the systems. So in these cases, we think all the white dwarfs probably have some field strengths that are kilogauss and above. But we can't really detect it. But in these, we think that there is really an actual thin ring, and the inner parts within the Alphaean radius come through in what we call accretion curtains onto the magnetic poles. And that produces a visible spin that we can detect. And the orbital periods of these things are generally long, and by long I mean 3.5 hours in our cases, and the spin periods are typically 20 minutes. Okay, brief evolution. We think these things start out as two stars, and as the more massive star fills its Roche lobe, it creates a common envelope. We could probably spend a whole KITP session on common envelope physics, because there's so much that's unknown there. But that common envelope causes the stars to move together, so they become really close. So when they emerge from the common envelope, they're not transferring mass. They're widely separated, and by widely separated, I mean periods of several, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours. And then it's angular momentum losses, not evolution, that drives them further together, and until the secondary fills its Roche lobe and it transfers mass and it becomes a cataclysmic variable. Okay, so we can do population studies and try to piece together how we think they've evolved and where they are now and what properties we can surmise based on observables that we see. So the period, as I said, is the fundamental parameter that we use to characterize the systems. So this diagram was put together, Steve and Lauren Nelson and Saul, back in 2001, and there's some recent ones by Lauren Nelson and his student that deals with the evolution, the secondary being slightly evolved, but I won't get into that complication at this point. Basically, this diagram is showing you what the accretion rate is as a function of the orbital period. And this you can think of as just luminosity, because that's the driver for where most of the energy is coming from. So when it comes out from the common envelope, it's up here somewhere. And then as magnetic braking is the angular momentum loss, drives it closer together, the stars move on a track down here as they age. So when they reach here, at this little gap here between 2 and 3 hours, we don't pick up systems. And the cause is believed to be due to the low mass secondary becoming totally convective, which stops the magnetic braking, or it could be star spots or whatever. But there, it ceases mass transfer in here, so there's a little gap. And then what takes over is just gravity radiation. And so they'll move down in here. Eventually they reach some period minimum, which is near 80 minutes, 70 to 80 minutes, depending on the model you use, and when the secondary becomes degenerate and then the period starts to increase. So the point here is that selection effects, because these systems are brighter, we've always concentrated on those in the past. But as we've gone to fainter and fainter surveys, like the Sloan and other upcoming surveys, ZTF, et cetera, LSST, we should be finding all these. And SDSS has really helped because it was able to find these. The point is, when you get down to these low periods where most of the systems is color-coded, so you should, population models say, up to 90% of the system should be down here, whereas most of the ones we've found before have been up here. It's selection, and we're actually starting to see these. And these are the systems that have the lowest mass transfer rates. So the disks, that affects the disk structure. All right, so we'll get into the way that dwarf nova outbursts have been explained. Back in the 1980s, there was a big burst of activity by several people in this room, as well as a variety of authors. They came out with this disk instability model to create the outburst. Since the 80s, of course, there's been other parameters introduced, like the tidal effects and MRI, and Matt after me will be talking about some of the other effects that you'll see. But basically, you have a steady mass transfer rate, and we have to be careful to distinguish the transfer rate from the secondary to the accretion rate onto the white dwarf, which can or cannot be the same. All right, so if you assume a steady mass transfer rate coming over, then as a function of time, and this can be considered temperature or accretion rate, the disk builds up and builds up as a function of surface density until it reaches some critical point, and then you have to create a jump in viscosity to get it to a high state here. And that is basically the state when the disk is steady and will not undergo outbursts. And then it cools down, so you have a cooling wave, and then it jumps back down to the quiescent. And usually the jump in alpha has been a factor of 10, so 0.01 down here and 0.1 up here. Now, there are other means of getting the alpha to be high, and that's part of the problem. So in terms of observables, in terms of this log orbital period, we can divide the accretion rate into basically four different areas. And don't worry so much about these little, all these little notes, the subdivisions that we have within the CV community. But there's basically these four sections here. In this section, you've got normal dwarf nova outbursts. You're below this critical line that distinguishes the high state situation of the disk from the low state situation of the disk. So this is the quiescence, this is outburst. So the nova-likes are above this line, so they're not going to have any outbursts. The ones that are below this line should have outbursts. Now, as you move to the left, you're moving over to the areas of the systems that have mass ratios that are less than 1/4, and that's when tidal effects start to come in. So you have tidal effects down in here, and tidal effects, in addition to this, the transitions, you get what we call super outbursts. And as you move toward smaller and smaller orbital periods, you basically have all super outbursts, whereas if you're over in this area, you're going to have normals as well as super outbursts. So that's just an observational characteristics. And up in here, you have what are called permanent super outbursts. I won't get into those. Okay, so just as everyone knows what a super outburst is, by our definition, this is Kepler data on V344 Lyra, which is just under the period gap, period just over around 2 hours. And you can see there's a whole series of normal dwarf nova outbursts, quasi-periodic. Every single period has a typical, every single object has a typical quasi-period associated with it, but that can range from a week for some systems to many years for other systems. So the ones that are in that lower left of the diagram that I just showed you will have these super outbursts, SOBs, which is another, there's another name for SOBs, but, and as you see, the data are excellent because it's Kepler data, and so this variation that you see here at the top of the SOB is actually what do we call a super hump, which is thought to be due to the disk reaching the 3-to-1 resonance and becoming eccentric, and it causes variations that are a few percent longer than the orbital period and very evident in the light curve. They're like 20%, 20 or 30% variability. Okay, so just a toy model of what we're talking about here. So typically at quiescence or low M-dot systems, where the disk is basically kind of thin looking and their boundary layer is optically thin, we see a lot of X-rays. As you go into outburst or for a nova-like situation system at a high state or a steady state for nova-likes, the disk becomes very extended and thick, and the boundary layer becomes like black body that's emitting in the EUV at temperatures of a few hundred thousand degrees. All right, so that's the basic overview in a nutshell. And now I want to get into the things that I think we have yet to find explanations for. So I'm going to show you a lot of different kinds of outbursts that are occurring. Some of them we think we have a handle on what's happening in terms of the shape and the amplitude. And others, in my mind, are a puzzle. And I'd really like to see a theorist come out with a model of an outburst that can reproduce what we're seeing. There's also some long photometric periods that have been known for a number of years, and we don't think they're certainly not solved. And by long, I'm talking about hours, 5 to 12 hour periods that are evident at large amplitudes, few 20 or 30% in the light curves. And these are occurring in systems that have orbital periods that are very close to the period minimum. So something is happening in the disk structure in those systems. We see rapid switches in disk visibility from night to night with no change in the optical magnitude. And I'd like to know how the disk can appear or disappear so quickly. And lastly, double hump orbital periods in the short period system. So I'll be showing you examples of all these. Okay, for the outbursts, there's lots of things that we don't totally understand about the outbursts. There's a shape to the outbursts, symmetric and versus asymmetric. This has been partially explained as the outbursts starting closer into the white dwarf or farther out. Whether that's really happening or not, we still don't have great evidence if that's the right explanation or not. There are precursors. There's the little outbursts that start and then start to go down and go up from there. So something is triggering an outburst, whether it's transfer or tidal instability or whatever. There's information to be gained from the late decline in outbursts, which are different between systems. And then standstills in the systems that are very close to that critical line, if they're going to have outbursts or not outbursts. And then lastly, I'll talk about the intermediate polar outbursts. So that's all under outbursts. All right, we have lots of data on the outburst that goes back a long period of time. So the amateurs have been following the system for over 100 years. And I think that, you know, some of the Titari people should get the amateurs to start following them for 100 years, and then maybe they could see some of the repetitive structure that we talked about this morning. This is a system, it's not typical. It's bright, that's why it's been followed. So each line here is 7 years long. And the orbital period of the system is 6.6 hours, so it's way on the high end of high mass transfer. And it typically has periods of round outburst period, time scale of about 40 days, but you can see the tremendous variety in the outburst. Lately, we've had the Catalina Real Sky Survey that's been going now for about 10 years. I'm just showing you this to give you an idea of what night-to-night variability, if you observe, would look like. This time span is almost 10 years, a little over 9 years in each case. And you can see for the systems that have a very low, the ones that are down near 10 to the minus 11, they sit there very faint for 9 years and then will have one very high amplitude outburst. And that's the characteristic that must be explained for the low M dots. As you get into the high M dots systems near 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 9, you get many more outbursts and they're not quite as large amplitude. So Catalina has almost 1,400 CVs that they're finding because of the variability. The other thing that's come on is Kepler. The Kepler data had, I don't know, somewhere on the order of 15 CVs in it. But now with K2, they're changing the field. So we're getting a wide sampling of CVs close to the galactic plane and away from the plane, and it's great. So we've been putting in every CV we know about into the fields that, because they tell you the fields ahead of time. And so there's been 60 so far, and many more are in the pipe, and we're down at K211, I think, is going on right now, and it's supposed to go to like 15, I think, before it dies. So the cadence is 30 minutes for long and 1 minute for short. They don't do very many 1 minutes, but for eclipsing systems, those are great. But it gets continuous photometry for 80 days. And so the light curves are exquisite in terms of the detail we get out, in terms of the shapes and the numbers. So here's a system from K27, orbital period fairly long, so high M dot. And you can see just the tremendous difference in the kinds of outbursts that are happening, the shapes and the decline here versus similar. And I like this one, HS-FER, it's a short period system. Should have a long sequence between outbursts, but it doesn't. There's, you know, four of them within the 80 days. So there is a large range in what I've been telling you in terms of not every single short period system has this long sequence. What you can see here is the difference in the shapes as you go through. So this one is symmetric, and in the instability model, it should be at inside out, which happens for low M dot systems. And then as the next one progresses, it's outside in, because it's getting more and more asymmetric. And also, they're getting larger. And then finally, so this would make sense in terms of a buildup of the accretion. It doesn't totally empty out, and then so the next outburst gets to go. But then I have no idea. This is the one I would like to see. We're seeing more and more of these with it's almost split in half. So it's like almost halfway down and then decides to go into outburst again. So what is in a disk structure that could actually have that happen? And here's another one of my favorites from K24. This is done with the Catalina, the Mount Lemmon telescope there. So it has these, you know, three little ones that come through. Look at the structure in between. There's a lot of stuff going on, like flickering in between. These are not periodic in any sense. Then there's this split super outburst. And then afterwards, you start to get this, again, it's not periodic, even though it kind of looks like that. Notice the amplitude is less for the ones that are outbursts afterwards than the one before. So this is basically kind of cleared out the disk, perhaps. The other thing to notice is look at the structure at quiescence after big outburst versus before. It's much quieter. So the disc has kind of really settled down after the this large outburst. The other thing I want to mention is precursors. So there's this is a super outburst. They're very long, something like 20 days. This is the typical shape for a super outburst. It has this little ledge coming up before the outburst starts. So something that starts up, comes to some kind of halt, and then goes to the full steady disk. And we see these, it was originally thought super outbursts only happen when you have the tidal effects for the Q ratios less than a quarter. But now the precursors are beginning to be seen at longer period systems. As well. And so it's not just a tidal effect at short period. And this is a very nice example of that precursor. So this super outburst isn't quite as long as 20 days, but it's there. It's longer than the usual. So the other thing we've been looking at besides the start of the outburst is what happens when the disk is cooling off and going back to its quiescent level. And this work is being done with Zhibin Dai, who was a sabbatical visitor at UW from Yunnan Observatory, and we're still working on some of the Kepler data. He noticed there was a real difference in the declines, whereas in some cases it would go down to a smooth decline. He was just trying to fit some smooth shapes to these. But in others, it's kind of this linear trend which lasts for 3 or 4 days. This is 344 Lyra, the one I showed you as an example of a super outburst earlier. And you can see there's a lot of outbursts that happen for it, but some are smooth, and then you have this linear decline again. So we'll be concentrating on looking at that linear decline. And we did this for TWBER. This is, again, the same light curve I showed you earlier. So we looked at what was happening to the orbital modulation. Now, the orbital modulation is usually there's a single hump. So it's probably due to the hot spot. We're seeing the hot spot as we go around the orbit. The period of the system shows up. So this is a running power spectrum as you go through the light curve. The 4.4 hour orbital modulation shows up very clearly before the super outburst happens. And then it disappears during the outburst. And as the disk rebuilds, it starts to reappear in here at basically a double modulation. I'll show you what that actually looks like here. But it becomes very strong right after the super outburst. And then as it goes into another normal outburst, it's not as strong. So the disk has a different structure to it after these large outbursts than it does after the normals. And so this is the pre-super outburst light curve, a single hump here from the hotspot, and post-super outburst, it has this other structure halfway around. So is that an overflow from the hotspot to the other side? Is that a long-running thing that persists for a while and then it reverts back to a single hump? So the other point I wanted to make here, this is when it's reappearing, and that's a 3.7-day time scale. Which is, you know, similar to what we saw in those other ones. So there's something magical, or the time scale is telling us something about how the disk is restructuring itself. If you look at the critical line, the systems that are above it don't have outbursts, and below it do, the Z-cams are the ones that sit right at that line. And the light curves of the Z-cams are very interesting. The outbursts seem to... The disk is building up, and then it goes into the permanent state. And usually after that, it's just going to cool down and go back to quiescence after standstill, because that's the only place it can go, because it's not going to have outbursts. Well, that's what we thought until Mike Simonson from the AVSO found three systems that instead, after a standstill, go up to outbursts. It shouldn't happen. At the standstill, you're above the critical zone. You shouldn't have outbursts. So Jean-Pierre and Jean-Marie have come up with an explanation that this could be possible if you just get enhanced mass transfer here, and then it just dips on down. I don't know if this sequence is real or just part of the observations. The other interesting thing is to look at the ones that just have rings. So they're definitely truncated in the middle. These have magnetic fields. Okay. They have a range. There's 9 of these known now. The ones I want to point out are the 2 that have extremely short outburst timescales. So when this happens in the ring situation, the whole outburst is only like 4 or 5 hours long. I was at IUE when its TV call went into outburst, and I thought within 30 minutes, the whole thing had changed so much that we thought the satellite had moved to a different star, and we had to check the coordinates, because it happens so fast. Within 30 minutes, you have P-Cygni profiles showing wind outflow, you have high excitation carbon and nitrogen lines, and then the whole thing goes back in time scales of an hour or so. So it's a very fast, and the question is, can you get this, if you compare these to other kinds of objects that have flares or whatever, it's totally different. Too short to have a normal disk outburst that would spread out to the interior of the white dwarf and back. Okay, so that was outbursts. I want to say a little bit about long photometric periods that we see in the short period systems. This was first noticed by Gagik. I think he's going to be here in a couple weeks on FS Origi. You notice that all of the orbital periods that we see this in are very short, very close to the orbital period minimum. The amplitudes of the long periods, so I'm calling this photometric hours, they're 5 to 12 hours. It's not strictly periodic, but definitely comes and goes. They're high amplitude, usually several tenths of a magnitude in these systems. And just to show you some examples, so this would be the photometric modulation. I'll talk about 2 humps per orbit in a minute. But all of a sudden, it increases by 1/2 a magnitude, and you see these orbital modulations increase. So this is, here's another better example, paper by Avilis. They followed it for many days, and you can see the same thing recurring over and over again. So something is causing a jump in the disk magnitude and that orbital modulation to increase. We notice this is happening in GW-LEAB, a dwarf nova that has a very short orbital period, 76 minutes. We had an HST program, so we followed it for about 2 weeks in a row. And you can see here, this is the 2-hour modulation. And it's relatively coherent because you can follow it for like 3 nights in a row and it's right in step. 20 or 30% of variation, and here it is. And then all of a sudden, we missed, unfortunately, the transition. Night in here was cloudy. But you can see it transitions to a 4-hour period. So we don't understand what could be causing. It's such a long, it's not the precession period because it's not periodic of a disk, but some disk change is happening. And we saw this after, it's a dwarf nova, 2007. It had a very large amplitude outburst. We saw it in the galaxy start to form this 4-hour variation in the ultraviolet. This is the optical, this is the UV, this little line joins the same night in the optical as the UV, and it's apparent in both. So it's a very large phenomenon that comes and goes over the years. This is sort of related to disk visibility here. In SW UMA, noticed way back in 1983 that this system has a very prominent orbital modulation from a hotspot, supposedly. We have spectra at the same time as the photometry, and the spectra locate a specific component that is opposite to where you'd normally see a mass transfer hotspot. So apparently we're seeing the other side of the hotspot or an enhanced region of overflow over the disk. So this is something that has to be taken into account. But the other thing I want to show here, this is the typical light curve of SW-UMA. These 2 nights are 1 night apart, March 8th, March 7th. The night before, this orbital modulation went completely away and was replaced by a period that we don't know what it's due to of 16 minutes, and it's seen in the X-ray as well. So somehow we can get disk changes, and notice this red line marks the magnitudes taken with the same instrument. It's 16.2 in the orbital, so it's fainter when the orbital modulation is there as when that goes away. So So how do you make that disappear without changing the brightness? And the same thing happens. We've been looking at stars that pulsate, the white dwarf pulsates, and we can see that pulsation just somehow disappear and revert to superhumps without any change in the optical magnitude. So this is typically a pulsating white dwarf. So it means that you're seeing the white dwarf. The disk is a minor contributor. Here's the nice Fourier transform of it. And then over a sequence of time, and this is a longer time period, we can't see the transformation from one night to the next because we don't have that data. But this is where the superhump appears. And the magnitudes, when the superhump is there, these are magnitudes. Don't worry about the red versus the blue. They're 19, basically 19.1. There's no change in the total brightness of the disk when it changes to superhumps for when you can see the pulsating white dwarf. So, and it's one or the other. You either see the white dwarf and the disk not there, or you see the superhumps and not the pulsation behind it. Same thing apparent in GW Leap. Here's the pulsating white dwarf, and then at other times the superhump is apparent. So the last thing I want to mention is the double orbital humps. So this is a common phenomena that we see in light curves of systems that are short orbital period. So the humps can change over time, but there's two of them, okay? So here's this particular object back in 2003, Joe Patterson's paper, and then we got some recent data on it with when we were doing HST. You see the humps are equal amplitude here and very different there. So there's some structure in the disk that's creating this and creating differences. And there's lots of explanations for these. Could be hotspot overflow from phase 0.7 to phase 0.3. Could be spiral arm structure in the disk. Could be the 2-to-1 resonance in the disk. Has been another explanation. The problem with tidal or resonance effects is that we're now seeing these, you would expect those to be only in the short orbital period systems. And you'd expect the spiral structure to be there all the time. And Paul tomorrow will talk about spiral structure in the AMCAN bands, even shorter period systems. But you can't really have this due to the tidal effects because we're seeing this in several systems now that have periods that are 4 hours, 4 to 5 hours. And so you shouldn't have this kind of structure there. So there's really no good explanation that can satisfy everything. So here's my summary of the unanswered questions. If you have any explanations for these, I'd be very happy to talk about them while I'm here. Let me know now. How do you explain all the shapes and timescales that we see in a common model of dwarf nova outbursts? How do we get these longer period disk modulations in the short orbital period systems? And how do we get the disk to change from one night to the next without actually changing its overall brightness? How the structure is obviously changing. And how do we get those spiral arms? We heard about spiral arms this morning. Okay, so let's end there.
Okay, questions?
So I'd be interested to see how the energy spectrum changes between these periods of outburst and then these periods of quiescence. Have we got any data on that?
You mean a total from like X-ray to UV?
Yeah, as broadband as you can get.
Well, certainly, when an outburst happens, the ultraviolet goes up by huge amounts. So the inner disk is basically becoming very hot. In the X-ray, as I showed in that one picture, the boundary layer, because you have an increased accretion, the X-ray changes to optically thick from optically thin. So we have that kind of information. We don't have it in terms of the details of like what's happening in those stunted outbursts that I showed. So we don't really are able to characterize what's happening in the inner disk versus the outer disk when that's happening. Yeah, so we have, for the general overall picture of a dwarf nova outburst, I think we have pretty good constraints from the UV and the distribution. It's definitely disk-dominated, and it's basically, well, the eclipse mapping, I don't want to get into eclipse mapping, but the structure is marginally consistent with a steady state disk at outburst, would you say that, versus quiescence? The problem with, you know, quiescence, even though, I mean, in my standpoint, we're talking about, you know, the vast majority of systems are at quiescence in these low MDOT cases, and that's the case where the disk is really totally, the distribution is not even known. And it's hard to get that out. We have a handle, if we take UV spectra, we can sort out, the white dwarf is contributing a lot of flux. So, it's a little bit cleaner in the UV because we can get a handle on the white dwarf from the absorption lines and the Lyman alpha, whereas the optical, it's very difficult to sort out a disk contribution because, you know, you just don't have a good handle on the lines. So we can do that in some cases, and then but then we only have a small wavelength distribution to try to get in any model. I mean, we can fit black bodies, we can fit power laws. We really don't know what the total SED of the disk itself is at quiescence.
Daniel?
So this meeting is about confronting MHD accretion theory with observations. So are you expecting that the answer to all of unanswered questions is it's magnetism of the disk?
You tell me. I don't think you can get enough. I think it has to be a combination of things. But I would just like to see How do you get actually the whole shape of the structure of the disk? I mean, when you include magnetic effects, you can include turbulence, et cetera, which is more important. I think Matt will talk about when, like, convection is more important in some states than others. But how do you get it from starting from the quiescence? You include all the effects you need, and how do you get it through to the outburst and back down again, explaining the shape correctly?
So in your disk structure changing without brightness changing, was that only the magnetic systems?
No, those are not magnetics.
They were non-magnetics.
Yeah. Right. Well, okay, SW UMA, we're not sure about. It could be, because that 16-minute could be a spin period of the white dwarf, in which case then it's truncated and would have some magnetic field, but we don't have a measurement of the field. Yeah. It could also be a pulsation, but either case, you know, that we're not, the brightness is not changing, and yet the structure has to be changing for us to see different things one day apart. Okay. With no outburst or burst of mass transfer, so there has to be some other mechanism that is changing the superhump structure should be an eccentric disk, right? So if you're seeing a superhump, should be seeing an eccentric disk. Yeah. And so you've got to go from an eccentric disk to a disk of the same brightness, which is not modulated at the same size, because it's got to be, if it's 3-to-1 resonance, it should have shrunk.
Well, I was thinking that maybe what you were seeing was more optical emission from the flow as opposed to from the outer disk. Your modulation came from the outer disk, but it was a modulation onto a constant optical emission that came from maybe the hotter flow inside.
Then the flow would have to be thick enough to produce all the continuum.
Yeah.
Jean-Marie?
Yeah, I have a comment on the question. The comment is about the very short outbursts you find in magnetic systems. It is very clear that these outbursts cannot be due to the disk instability or to a mass transfer instability, because the timescale of these outbursts, the duration of these outbursts, is shorter than the viscous timescale of the burst. So it is probably one of the cases where this could originate from the interaction of the inner part of the disk with the magnetic field of the white dwarf. And it is interesting from that point of view, and I would like you to confirm it, that you do not find these very short outbursts in non-magnetic systems, do you?
Not on the time scale of ours, no. Yeah.
So probably the fact that the white dwarf is magnetic is plays an important role. Therefore, it would be nice if one could have MRI simulation interactions with the white dwarf, the magnetic field of the white dwarf, just to add in the complexity of this system, like in Titauri or in other systems.
If you do an outside-in outburst and just bounce it off the field.
No. This will happen in a viscous timescale in all cases. So you cannot have something which varies on something which is shorter than the viscous time scale if this is related to normal outburst.
Well, I think the other thing, I don't know if I mentioned it, is that we did see, we have a time scale for the, we saw definite P Cygni profiles because we were using the IAU satellite. They lasted for 1.5 hours. So there was outflow happening for 1.5 hours. And I don't know if that affects the disk structure in terms of getting rid of stuff. But I mean, that, I think that's a pretty, we actually, I mean, usually you don't see, you don't have the time span to see how long the outflow is lasting. And in this case, we definitely know it was 1.5 hours.
So for the system you showed where the outburst went halfway down and then went back again that you put a, that you said we didn't understand.
The, oh, the outburst, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
right,
the one
the
that
middle.
Went halfway down and
right,
then went back up. You
right.
had a question mark over it. Do we have a power spectrum for that?
A power spectrum. I mean.
Yeah, right. Right, right.
No. Yeah. No, no. I mean, well, in that system. Right, yeah. Right. What would you be looking for in a power spectrum?
So I wanted to see whether there are like there are actual significant power in oscillations of the light curve.
Like, I mean, like the noise.
It actually is on. Okay.
Okay.
What kind of
theories
would you be looking for? Just like
short, like much shorter periods.
Much shorter ones, right? Exactly.
Yeah. You've asked us all these questions about strange behaviors, but If you were a Martian trying to understand human beings, I think the first questions you would ask would not be about individual eccentricities, differences between, but most basic things about, you know, how long do people sleep, you know, what do they eat, and so forth. So, in that spirit, can you tell? It seems it would be very useful to theorists have the following three quantities, which in principle should be observable. The mass transfer striking the hotspot, which in principle you should be able to work out because you know its radius and you could get its bolometric luminosity.
Right.
The luminosity of the boundary layer.
That's your new X-rays.
And maybe the disk. And, mm-hmm. and those three quantities, you know, through the outburst and quiescent cycle. Is that...
Christian is working on that.
Yeah, so maybe I'll put an advertisement up tomorrow for this. I'm basically trying to do something insane, like actually, I think what we need to do, not just for dwarf novae, but for transient accretion in general, I think part of the trouble is that we don't know how any of the things we see are causally connected. So we talk about, you know, optically thick to thin switches, changes in variability character, you name it. But we don't know which comes first, which comes second, what triggers what. Are the winds before the jets? Are the jets before the winds? None of this stuff. But in principle, in CVs, they're the one kind of systems where you can actually do this in real time. So there are systems that outburst for maybe a week. So if you give me a week of preferably triggered HST, Chandra, XMM, ground base, and radio time, then
we can solve
this.
It, yeah.
And that is not quite as insane as it sounds. It's pretty insane, but that is what we're currently trying to get off the ground, actually. And it turns out the biggest challenge, well, apart from getting huge amounts of time, the biggest challenge is actually finding systems that are just right, so that you know that they have all of these characteristics in observable ways that erupt for the right amount of time, that it's not completely crazy. And even though we have 1,000 of these things, it's not easy. But I think it's doable. And the challenge is that you need to, and this goes directly to your question, the real trouble is that, and it's good and bad, that in CVs, all of these different components come out in different wavelengths. And so when a switch happens, for example, in the boundary layer, it switches completely from X-rays to basically EUV. Now, you need to actually see that happen if you want to use it for anything. But that means you have to simultaneously observe at all of these different wavelengths simultaneously. That's the challenge. I mean, it's good because you can actually dissect it, but it also means you have to have panchromatic coverage, which is tough.
And it's hard to do in a TOO because it's happening fast. So you've only got a few hours once you know it's going up to get all the satellites oriented.
Daniel was next,
right? Yes, I admit maybe I should know the answer to my question, but
Energetically speaking, when we integrate and sum up energy released during an activity and compare it with the quiescent time, is that contribution significant or negligible? So when we add up energy released during humps, super humps, to the overall...
You mean during a super outburst?
Yeah.
Well, there's a tremendous, there's a huge amount of energy coming out in the super outburst because the UV alone is going up by much.
So during that time, the system is releasing 10 times more energy than during the rest of the time?
Oh, probably more than that, I would say. Because the UV alone goes up, I mean, it's usually, the X-rays are shifted into the UVE, and the UV luminosity is probably going up 1,000, maybe 1,000 times, and yeah. Oh, you're talking about adding up the energy, So Ed Sion has done some work on taking the plateau of the super outburst and figuring out how much mass then that corresponds to in terms of the accretion onto the white dwarf.
I think it's likely, it's almost guaranteed that for virtually all dwarf novae, I suspect, at least a highly significant fraction of all the mass is transferred during outbursts. I think one of the challenges is that we don't really know exactly how much mass is transferred in quiescence.
The disk is still there. I mean, it's not like it disappears right afterwards. So, and I said, that's why I think, looking at that little transition time, there's something happening. The disk is like doing its several day relaxation back to what it was before. But it's basically down at quiescence. So it's low mass, but it's low accretion, but it takes that amount of time to settle. And so what does that mean in terms of the structure? I mean, why is it taking, so we've got several cases now where it's 3 to 4 days is when it's happening. So what's magical about 3 to 4 days in this system that would, is it a wave time? Is it, I mean, the cooling wave is already propagated, so there's something internal structure that's changing, and especially the structure of the hotspot. So that's telling you something about, the hotspot seemed to be maybe that's a little more mass transfer because it was, secondaries or could have been irradiated and maybe making a little more mass transfer for a while afterwards. I don't know. It's because that's the problem. We have this added thing about the mass transfer that we don't know, and it can turn off and on, and we don't know what's triggering that. So you have not only the stuff moving through the disk, but you have the stuff changing at the outer edge, and that's why I guess you need the, the whole spectrum.
I think we have one final question from Neil.
Given that the range of temperatures overlaps with F. Eurionis's disk, is there any reason why we couldn't do what Donati did and measure the disk magnetic field? So spectroscopically, looking at the Stokes V parameter, how it varies across
the polarization. It's really hard to, the problem is it's only been done for a couple of the IPs that we actually have a measurement of the field because the rest of the disk is contributing so much. And the polarization level is very low. So there's been more claims than are substantiated. So it's a really tough thing to do. But it's worth searching for. We're still talking about megagauss, and you're talking about kilogauss, right? So, it was kilogauss. Didn't you mention kilogauss?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's going to be even worse. Yeah.
And keep in mind that even non-magnetic CVs will have white dwarfs with like 10 to the 5 gauss.
Yeah.
Okay. We better.